So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
We got one. W's on the board.
Yes. Oh,
this is one. All right, Josh. What do you think, huh?
I don't know what to ask right now, but ECW is on the board here in the WWE draft. We're getting our first pick right now. Let's just find out who it is.
Come on. I'm hoping for John Cena. How about that?
Who's it gonna be?
Come on, make it good, please.
Oh! The Moscow Mauler! Vladimir Kozlov!
Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock alongside Wei Ting.
Yeah, it's me.
Are you ready to say goodbye to 2009 after today?
I think I am. For good.
You and I have spent more time than any other wrestling show detailing this time period.
Why did we do that? Why? Why did we all of a sudden decide to spend that much time on this very random year?
Because we've reviewed a lot of WrestleManias, and we realized this where we had three shows before this year's WrestleMania, and it was hard to squeeze in, so we did another show.
Well, why couldn't we have picked a better year?
There's no excuse for that one. We definitely had other options than 2009.
I think the only reason was because, honestly, it was really Shawn versus Taker. Like... WrestleMania 25? Oh, Shawn versus Taker. That one of the best matches of all time. Oh, I can't wait.
Oh, wait, they're also going to crown Miss WrestleMania? Sign me up.
We did not say that. But, I mean, to even get to that little great morsel took a lot of work.
Well, I'm not going to lie. I don't think we would have done this extra show reviewing the draft unless I had lined up this guest that we have on today's show. We are going to be joined by Brad Corbett, who is a member of the creative staff during this time period, and he's going to join us at the end of the show, and he's got lots of info about this time period, and he's also going to get to the bottom of the anniversary marketing.
Well, I look forward to that. That'll probably make this entire ordeal worth it.
Well, we're looking forward to having Brad on later in the show to chat WrestleMania, the build-up that year, the key programs, and the draft itself. Which is what we're chatting about today. This was a 3-hour edition of Raw back when that was a novelty and not the norm.
Mm-hmm.
This was a special occasion that they were going to go 3 hours for.
3 whole hours.
And now they do this every damn week.
Well, maybe we can look forward to a 4-hour edition of Raw for their special occasions.
It probably took me 4 years to get over the fact that the show was 3 hours and not.
Has it been 4 years?
Wait, it's been almost 5 years come this July that it's been a 3-hour Raw.
Wow. I guess like
now I'm just used to it, but it has probably taken me over 4 years for my body to adjust to sitting down every Monday for 3 hours. Maybe, you know, it was right around the time they added 205 Live, where now this is just Monday and Tuesday. It's a long period of time. Maybe that has subconsciously made Raw easier. Because you're actually watching more content Tuesday night because 205 Live and Talking Smack are commercial free.
Mm-hmm. Maybe that was the intent.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
God, there's a lot of stuff. This show took place from the Phillips Arena in Atlanta, Georgia, Monday night, April the 13th of 2009. I thought the greatest quote that rendered all of our prior reviews for this season of WrestleMania completely useless was Randy Orton's comment at the start of the show stating, WrestleMania proved nothing. I will get my rematch.
The main event of WrestleMania. Largely, meh, whatever.
Once they've got your $30, $40,
F them.
They could say, psych.
We've got your money. Now we need to get your money for the next damn show. So that is what we had to look forward to. Last week, so the night after WrestleMania, they had Orton threatening to go after Linda McMahon and the McMahon grandchildren even, and it set up a six-man tag for Backlash with Batista returning to take the spot of Vince McMahon in the main event six-man. So for about 2.5 hours, or I guess an hour and a half, you were left with the idea that Backlash will be headlined by Hunter teaming with Vince and Shane.
Jesus.
Wow. Exciting stuff coming out of WrestleMania.
Did they do that, though? Didn't they do that on Raw, at least?
They ended up doing – well, the prior week, they did Vince against Orton in the main event.
Right.
And then Vince was taken out of the main event and inserted was Big Dave, who was back. And
got it.
This was after his injury, where he had been out for months at this point. So our announced teams for this show, we had Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler on Raw, Jim Ross and Todd Grisham on SmackDown, and ECW's Josh Matthews and Matt Stryker.
A dream team.
Holy Christ.
Okay, well, to be fair, though, at that time on ECW, did you have the same opinion of them that you might now? Did you hate the team back then?
I did not. I thought Josh Matthews was always a pretty – I thought he was pretty good in WWE. I didn't have really any issue with Josh Matthews on this show. Matt Stryker, however, when he started on ECW, he was very good.
Mm-hmm.
But he quickly became this Matt Stryker, who was just painful, painful at times on this particular broadcast.
And what would you say is sort of like the defining characteristic of this version of Matt Stryker?
Just
a lot of pop culture references.
Bullshit would be the term that comes to mind. I have isolated quotes away, so I will back this up throughout the show here. But I just found him to be so just grating. It was. Did you have a different opinion? Did you enjoy him?
I didn't. I don't think necessarily enjoyed. You know, he was different. He sounded like a different type of color commentator than what they had. I didn't really have a strong opinion based on this edition of Raw either way.
Yeah, and this was also, of course, post-WrestleMania, so you have Grisham and Ross on SmackDown, with Ross in, like, the weird role of the color guy to Todd Grisham.
Yeah, that's really strange.
I thought it worked okay for Ross when he was part of the three-man booth at WrestleMania, but hearing him with Grisham, yeah, it was a strange role for Jim Ross.
Yeah.
At the time.
Well, you're so used to hearing him as, you know, the default play-by-play guy.
Right.
And to have him see, to me, like, it didn't even sound like he was the color guy. It sounded like he was sharing play-by-play duties with Todd.
Uh-huh.
And it was a little odd, sure.
All right, so we're going to go through this show. And the way they had set this up, it was much less a draft and more of, like, a lottery.
Yeah, so how it works is you have three brands, of course, and a set number of random drafts, and in order to see which brand gets that random draft, they will have a match prior to that lottery to see. So let's say if there's a Raw guy versus a SmackDown guy wins, and SmackDown happens to get that person in the random draft.
Yeah. So there's
a chance that Raw could have everybody. And SmackDown could have drafted nobody.
That was possible.
It actually did happen kind of with ECW.
ECW left the actual show with one goddamn pick.
Yeah.
And then they were going to do their usual supplemental draft 2 days later on their website, but to essentially just figure out what these rosters are all missing. But it was in storyline, you're right. It could decimate a brand. And there's no strategy to it. It's pure luck.
And it could also overinflate the salary of one particular brand.
You know what? That's what Raw and SmackDown needs. Salary caps.
Sure. Okay.
Ross sells Brock Lesnar to SmackDown because they just – it's too expensive.
But if we're talking about reality, though, one brand would happen to be incredibly overinflated in terms of price. The other would be
– ECW would have to be the Moneyball team. They would have been the Oakland A's of the early 2000s.
And what
going on a shoestring budget, and they have to they have to go with their metrics.
Sure.
Unconventional ways of scouting to try and be the superior product.
So this hasn't always been how they've done these draft shows. You know, anytime they've done a draft, this wasn't always the way they've done them, right?
Well, the original split, of course, was your traditional draft setup, and then they got away from that and then moved more towards this. So it was more just kind of surprises, and just more kind of tying them into an actual show. But they've kind of gone back and forth. I mean, what would you prefer? Like, after WrestleMania this year, it's very likely we'll get to see some swaps. Would you like to see this?
Yeah, I'm not in love with this format of just having guys randomly move from one show to another. And then and it's also really hokey when you have, the champion move from one brand to another, and then all of a sudden, by random luck, the other champion gets moved to the other brand as well. That's a little tough for me to buy. What I would prefer is just not even the whole draft. I want to see a set number of trades. Let's say 10 trades between, especially now that you only have Raw and SmackDown. Just pick 10 guys that you want to move back and forth, and that's it. Because you still, you spent all this time creating a certain identity with that brand. And, I think you should keep trades limited. So, I'd like to see them just implement some type of limited number of trades rather than even as many draft switches as they had here.
Yeah. I mean, that's maybe the happy medium, because to do a quote unquote draft, it would make no sense unless you're only moving the top guys. Like, why would one brand not draft the top guy on the opposing brand and instead they take Fandango? Like, it makes no sense.
Yeah.
So,
So if it was a trade, though.
Yeah, you can make that more logical.
Fandango for? Oh, what are the possibilities? What would you trade for a Fandango if you're the GM of, Raw?
Dana Brooke.
Yeah.
And pair Dana with Tyler Breeze.
I'd say that's a fair trade.
That should be the other trade, too, is that you've got to assume the role of the person you've been traded in their place.
Okay.
Yeah. So Fandango would be feuding with Charlotte after WrestleMania.
Okay. I would actually trade Fandango for maybe a first, second round NXT draft pick.
Oh, perhaps. Okay. Second round, not
maybe
even first.
Maybe even third. Yeah, I don't know if they'd go for that.
So this Raw in 2009 did a 3.74 rating, 5.46 million viewers. To put that into perspective, this past Monday's Raw did 3,040,000 viewers.
I feel like even in 7 years, the landscape has really changed. Not just, obviously with wrestling ratings, but I feel like with our viewing habits in general, don't you? A lot less people are watching TV now.
They are. However, the rating, it's only going to measure the people that are still getting cable. And that's also gone down drastically. Like, you would think that if wrestling fans were keeping cable, it would actually help their rating, even if their viewership goes down a bit. But you're right. There are a lot. I think that there's a lot of people that keep up with wrestling through, whether it's listening to shows like this, whether it's just going on the WWE's YouTube, and you can watch all the key segments. You can pick and choose what you watch because they're all up there instantly.
Or they'll just stream from a site.
Like, they're asking you to watch 3+ hours every Monday night, and you can keep up to date in a fraction of the time. Mm-hmm. You can dedicate 20 minutes to catching up on Raw.
Yeah.
And it's definitely – I think there's a lot of different factors that you can look at, but that is sizable. So the show kicks off, the announcers setting the scene for tonight's draft and going over all the different interpromotional matches you will see, including a 15-man tri-branded battle royal, which will be good for two picks. And what a battle royal to come.
Yes.
The t-shirts were out in full force.
One of those, yeah.
Batista comes out.
He's been out since December, the storyline being that he was punted in the head by Randy Orton, meaning that Vince McMahon recovered quicker than one Dave Bautista.
What was the legit reason for his absence?
He had, I believe, torn his hamstring, I think was the issue. And yeah, so he was out, missed WrestleMania over it too. And says he's been waiting to get his hands on Orton and challenges him to face him like a man. But instead, the other man, Shane McMahon, comes out. And he says that Orton tried to separate his head from his shoulders and attacked his family. He says he's the one getting retribution tonight on Orton, which prompts Triple H to come out. He says that all of Orton's attacks were about getting to him and his title. And he tells Batista he tried to take out his wife and Orton is his. Mm-hmm. This after, like, what was settled at WrestleMania?
Well,
wasn't that Hunter's revenge? Wasn't that the whole part? He won this match clean.
You could never have enough revenge.
He kicked him in the head.
I know, but a man, he threatened his wife.
But he got his revenge. Like, how many attacks is enough?
Maybe five.
He's living. I'm just saying, you got 30 minutes of silence in front of 70,000 people to get your revenge. Maybe it's time for Batista to get a chance. Yeah. He's been gone. He missed out on his payday. So then Chavo Guerrero Jr. wheels out Vicky Guerrero, who is now the full-time general manager of Raw. And she explains that the title will change by DQ or by countout when they have their six-man tag at Backlash. Got that?
No, actually. Repeat that.
Jesus. This six-man tag.
Yeah.
If...
Okay, so it's a six-man tag and... Okay, I get it.
Shane McMahon could hit Randy Orton with a chair and Orton would win Hunter's title. How confusing is that?
Okay. Right. So basically the only people eligible to win the championship are either Randy Orton or Triple H.
Or Triple H.
Right. Okay. So if anybody takes the pinfall on Triple H's team, let's say if Cody Rhodes pins Shane McMahon, Randy Orton becomes the champion. Right?
Sure.
But also if Cody Rhodes gets counted out, Triple H retains the title?
I guess. Dude, I'm...
Wow, this is awful.
Okay.
This is terrible.
Vicky had to explain that. And then she had to make tonight's main event, which she makes a handicap match in the favor of the babyfaces. It will be Hunter, Shane, and Batista against Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase. Not enough.
Yeah.
If they win, the person to score the fall gets a singles match with Randy Orton next week.
Oh, man.
There would be more to come later. Holy Christ.
Oh, you have to be a fucking mathematician to understand this opening segment, I feel.
You know what I never said when I was 8 years old with an 8-year-old maturity level, an 8-year-old intellect when I first started watching pro wrestling? I never once went to my mom or dad and said, this show is just too complicated to follow. Wrestling is really tough. I never said that. It's pretty simple. And shit like this makes it so fucking complicated that I had a headache just listening to what the hell was going to happen after the next 3 hours was over. Lord.
A segment like this is, I think, something that might sound okay on paper, but when you're watching it, it took me a couple, like, I had to rewind. Or it's either one of those things where, like, you're watching it, you don't really digest what's being said, and you kind of figure it out as the match is happening. But in my case, I actually had to go back to really study it to make sure I understood what was happening before I could continue. But it's simply one of those things that, like, upon first listen, it's really hard to try to convey to your audience in one go.
On top of that, of these Batista, Shane, and Hunter, are there any pairings with Orton that would excite you?
I mean, you saw Vince and you saw the Hunter match already.
You saw the Hunter match already. You saw the Shane match the prior month that we reviewed.
Oh, so you saw all three then.
You haven't seen Batista,
Batista
and Orton.
Batista. Well, I guess it would be Batista is the only one.
So the show kicked off with Rey Mysterio representing Raw and Evan Bourne representing ECW and getting set for the following month to take a trip to Niagara Falls to be interviewed by John Pollock in one of my favorite interviews of all time.
It is a classic John Pollock interview. It's a classic Evan Bourne interview, too.
It's awesome.
I mean, and it's up there on YouTube if people want to see it.
Amazing. I was looking forward to this. These two guys come out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This might have been the best match on the show.
Well, they got a whole 3.5 minutes. Mysterio was the Intercontinental Champion coming out of his win over JBL at WrestleMania. Stryker referred to Bourne as chronically high-flying. Chronically.
Was that intentional?
I don't know. Both Raw and the ECW teams were calling this match. Bourne went for a sunset flip powerbomb to the floor, but it's blocked, and a drop toehold sent Bourne into the barricade, which was called the Unforgiving Barricade.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for a barricade that actually holds up, and my bad, my bad.
Yeah.
This won't hurt.
So I forgive you.
Yes. There's a standing moonsault by Bourne for a two count. Mysterio lands a 619 and a top rope splash to pin Bourne. 328. Lawler says he could have watched this match for 3 hours. So that was a compromise.
I feel like that would be an improvement overall in this edition of Raw.
I don't feel Jerry Lawler would be as invested in minute 179 as he was in number three here. So we get the big screen, which was kind of indicative of where the roster was at this point. When they put the graphic up of the respective rosters, mm-hmm. and I'm seeing Jim Duggan up there in 2009 mm-hmm. and JTG, we get the very long roll through of all the different performers, and it lands on MVP, the United States champion, coming to Raw. And, you know, he had gone through this big losing streak, won the title at the end of this streak, and was kind of just on the back burner on SmackDown. Mm-hmm. And you would think, okay, well, maybe they're going to refresh this guy. That did not happen on Raw.
Right.
Unfortunately.
But the idea was to bring the title along with him.
Yes. The U.S. title was now on Raw with Rey Mysterio, at least on Raw at this moment with the IC title.
Yes.
I wonder what'll happen.
Yeah, I wonder what'll happen. What do you do with two titles? This is an issue that we might have to face. Or if there's a random stroke of luck, maybe the other team will draft the other champion.
There's definitely a lot of luck involved. Chief J. Strongbow was shown in the front row with Michael Cole stating, maybe he'll get drafted. He wasn't. Kane, representing Raw, took on Brian Kendrick from SmackDown with Ezekiel Jackson. And Todd Grisham, with a straight face, said that SmackDown's hopes rest on the shoulders of Brian Kendrick. Jim Ross completely dismissed Kendrick, stating, Ezekiel Jackson is the difference maker here. Kendrick slapped Kane, ran away from him. Jackson blocked Kane and then got dropped with a Kane big boot. The sliced bread was blocked and Kane chokeslammed Brian Kendrick. In 46 seconds, he was pinned.
They were all very quick matches, and they had to, I guess, have time for the entrances and also the draft picks. So, yep, this was 46 minutes. Seconds,
yeah. Jerry Lawler could have watched this for 46 minutes. The Raw pick was the Big Show. So yeah. Raw now with two picks.
Did you know, John, that the WWE is available in more Chinese households than the MLB and NFL combined?
Oh boy,
I guess that's somewhat impressive.
Clearly a way bigger draft too than the baseball or football versions. Yeah.
But all it's really saying is that more people know about professional wrestling in China than baseball and American football.
Maybe a young Ho-Ho Loon was watching this 2009 draft thinking one day. Vicky and Chavo are in their office, and Randy Orton comes in, and he wants Chavo to leave. He is pissed about this handicap match idea for tonight. He says the board of directors will not be happy. So Vicky decides, you know what this match needs? Another stipulation. She says, that if Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase win, whoever they pin will face all of Legacy
in a 3-on-1 handicap match.
Mm-hmm.
Got that?
Yeah.
We're going to have an exam at the end of this show, folks, okay, to explain next week's main event.
Like algebra.
Oh, my God. John Cena approached Jack Swagger, who, keep in mind, was the ECW champion at this time. And they were going to have a match tonight. Champion versus champion in the loosest term possible.
Mm-hmm.
Champion versus champion. Swagger says, "The champ is here." And because this match is so huge, the winner of this champion versus champion match will get two picks for their brand. And Swagger says that he will be the new poster boy of the company.
What could have been?
Yeah, what wasn't. Swagger then calls himself the All-American American. And Cena describes how dumb this nickname is. Cena says Swagger's good, but he's a punk kid with a few wins under his belt, and now he's on Raw, the big time. And he is going to get a lesson in respect. Respect. And Lawler says that this will be good. Good. Holy shit.
Yeah.
Shit. I wish Talking Smack was around so that JBL could give Jack Swagger some advice on slogans and catchphrases.
Mm-hmm.
This was brutal, and this made Jack Swagger look like the ECW champion in 2009.
Yeah, the segment was definitely scripted to be very weak. I can't help but feel like if I had watched this in the context of the time back then, that I probably wouldn't think it was so bad. Because I'm watching it, comparing it to what we get today, which isn't always necessarily great. But I feel like we've gotten a lot better than segments like this.
Yeah, this was such a one-sided promo that I think Raw got a draft pick out of this promo backstage. Maryse, Michelle McCool, and Natalya took on Melina, Mickie James, and Kelly Kelly, with Maryse, the Divas champion, and Melina, the women's champion at the time. Kelly Kelly was also wrestling in winter boots at this time. Lawler says that if Melina is drafted to SmackDown, Grisham can show her his stamp collection.
Hey, Todd, yeah, if Melina came over to SmackDown, you can invite her over to look at your stamp collection.
I'll do that.
He's got a vintage stamp collection, I'll have you know.
She can lick my stamps anytime.
James hit a Hurricane Rana to McCool out of the corner, came off the top, was caught with a McCool boot, and this revolutionary women's match ended in a minute 14.
The other girls didn't even tag in.
They did not even get in the match.
It was just McCool and Mickey, and the other girls were just standing on the apron. What's the point?
They were trying to recreate the attention they received at WrestleMania.
I don't get it. Why even have these girls appear?
It made no sense. So SmackDown gets their first pick of the night, and it is Melina, the women's champion. That means that Raw doesn't have any women's champion, way.
No.
They have Maryse and Melina on one brand. Yeah. What will happen?
Damn.
The state of the company is just in disarray.
I think it really shows how little they valued the women's wrestling at the time when they decide to put multi-girls into a multi-girl match and just basically have them out there for the entrances and to look pretty on the apron. And it kind of gives off the impression that, you know, the money in these girls is simply in the entrances and looking pretty on the apron. So nobody wants to see the wrestling anyway. So let's just get that over with as quickly as we can.
What is the – when Beth Phoenix goes into the Hall of Fame and they play her video – what is that video going to look like?
Oh, they'll have enough stuff, I guess.
Like, I'm just saying how they position it. Like, here she was, a rare standout during a time, maybe the worst couple of years for the WWE women in the last two decades was here.
What's her story? What's her narrative?
Beth Phoenix, who triumphantly eliminated the Great Khali via a French kiss and also feuded with cross-dressing Santino Marella. During the height of the Divas division.
A trailblazer. True trailblazer.
Beth Phoenix is honored.
Grisham says he's going to get his stamp collection ready and says he will miss Melina's entrance. Or sorry, that's what Lawler says because she's leaving Raw. Cole asks if Lawler will miss the women's title being on the show.
He's going to really miss her entrance. Yeah, but what about the women's championship? Are you going to miss that? I'm going to really miss her entrance.
Honest. The segment from SmackDown last week showcased Cena challenging Edge to hit him and Edge walking away. So they're going to have a last man standing match at Backlash for the world title, I believe.
We'll see. Who knows?
Then we got the champion versus champion match. Not happening at the pay-per-view, no. What a treat for your Raw viewers tonight. John Cena and Jack Swagger. This was where Stryker began for me. We had Stryker calling Cena the pop culture superstar, which didn't take off. He clotheslined Swagger to the floor. Swagger then took over inside the ring, applied a full Nelson, was working on the neck of Cena, which he had been out for in 2008. We actually got a Let's Go Swagger chant at one point. Cena then powers out of the full Nelson, hit his flying shoulder blocks, suplex, hit the five-knuckle shuffle, and then Swagger grabs the ropes to avoid the AA. They went through a break, and the announcers put over how Swagger is giving the world champion a big test. Swagger just spins around, finally hits a DDT, but overextended himself here. And then Swagger hit a power slam for a two count, goes for the Swagger bomb, but lands on the shoulders of Cena, who hits the AA, applies the STF, and gets the submission victory.
Yeah, the crowd seemed into this, and they actually gave quite a bit to Swagger against John Cena here. Afterwards, the announcers tried to put the focus on Swagger, saying how Cena was really put to the test by this young ECW champion. What do you think? What did you think about promoting a guy off the bat 4 months in as an ECW champion, and where do you think they kind of fell off with his push?
This was a bad use of Jack Swagger on this show, because when he started in ECW, he definitely had something, and they just went with these bad ideas for him, like the all-American. He wasn't a great promo, but a good athlete, college credentials from his wrestling days. I mean, there was a lot to work with here with this guy. And they just never went anywhere with him. And that's probably, you can't fault the company for all of that. I mean, he wasn't someone that was so great that you just looked at him as being completely underutilized. But I certainly had higher hopes than what he ended up as in the company over the next number of years. The first Raw pick, because they got two here for Cena's win. The first was Matt Hardy. So the end of our Jeff and Matt feud coming to a screeching halt. And then the next pick, Triple H, the WWE champion.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, Raw has both belts.
They have both belts.
They have both, or SmackDown has both women's titles.
Yeah. So maybe
it's fair.
Easy. Yeah. Easy distinction. Lawler yells they won the lottery as Hunter comes out with the WWE title and gestures to John Cena in the ring. But then Edge jumps Cena from behind and, they just plug the match at Backlash. Edge misses running into the corner and then sneaks away going up the ramp. So to recap, Raw has now got MVP, Big Show, Matt Hardy, and Triple H. And as you look at things, Hunter spent a year on SmackDown from the prior year's draft. And,
But did he really? The guy was involved in the main event here.
He'd been going back and forth throughout the WrestleMania season.
Exactly. Teaming with Shane and Batista. So I can't really feel all that excited about, Triple H moving to Raw when he's been a featured person on Raw for weeks.
Orton's in the locker room and Cody and Ted DiBiase walk in, and they had the unenviable task of trying to explain the stipulations for tonight's match. And Orton wants to know what their strategy is. And then DiBiase just says, well, those guys aren't going to get along, so we assume that they'll argue and get disqualified.
That's our strategy.
And Orton is perfectly satisified with this plan. Okay, you guys got this. Yeah. They will argue and self-destruct. Don't worry. They recap Beth Phoenix challenging Santina last week. And as they're recapping this, They used the Billy and Chuck theme for Santina. So Santino Marella, representing Raw, took on the Great Khali from SmackDown. Before the match begins, Beth comes out with her intern, Rosa Mendez, and before the match, she says that she spoke to Vicky and says that if the Great Khali wins, then Santina will be on the Khali Kiss Cam next week with the Great Khali.
I think that's just a sentence that perfectly captures WWE in 2009.
And the best part, well, let's first, this match barely went any time. Marella clinged to the ropes and then took a chop to the head and was pinned in 1:03. So Great Khali wins. And then the following week on Raw, for the segment where Santina would have to kiss Khali, they moved it to the pay-per-view. So you would have to pay to see the Khali kiss cam.
Oh, wow.
Just,
okay.
Just tremendous momentum coming off of WrestleMania for that Backlash show. So the SmackDown pick, the Great Khali's win led to CM Punk moving to SmackDown. And he, of course, is the Money in the Bank briefcase holder. And Todd Grisham, there were two draft picks where his reactions were just adorable. This one went somewhere, something to the effect of, woo! Todd Grisham, now one of the voices of the UFC, calling the arrival of a UFC fighter to SmackDown.
Wow.
This would obviously be a great move for CM Punk, who was kind of flailing on Raw, and now he had the briefcase. SmackDown would eventually lead to the heel turn and that great feud with Jeff Hardy, and that was what really got CM Punk going in the WWE.
Mm-hmm.
The Miz, representing ECW in 2009, took on Kofi Kingston from Raw. And one of the sponsors here that they had to read was Axe. No matter what goes down, Axe has you covered.
Okay.
It's a very 2009 slogan to have. And The Miz's opponent, representing Raw from Jamaica, Kofi.
Yeah. Of these two, who would have thought that in 2 years, one of these guys would main event WrestleMania?
Highly improbable in 2009 would be my guess. And that both would be pretty solid in terms of having some of their best work coming now in 2017. I think Miz significantly better today than he was even in 2010, 2011, and definitely Kofi with the New Day stuff. So Michael Cole has to correct Jerry Lawler here because he identified The Miz and Morrison as the tag champions when they had lost the tag titles at a small house show called WrestleMania the prior week during the dark match. There was a jumping back elbow by Kofi, which Matt Stryker identified as right into the Facebook. Matthews called Miz and Morrison that they were having a bromance, which was obviously the first time Matt Stryker had ever heard this term.
So Miz is having separation anxiety?
What do you call their relationship, Josh?
It's a bromance.
A bromance.
Bromance.
Josh Matthews, ladies and gentlemen.
And adds that if the Miz fixed his hair, he would look like Dwight from The Office. Do you see a connection between The Miz and Dwight?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
There was a long headlock by Miz, not a headlick. And then a reverse chin lock, ran Kofi into the corner. And then there was a side Jamaican leg sweep. I'll give you two guesses who had that one. And a high cross, a boom drop by Kingston for a two count. Called for the trouble in paradise. Miz ducked it. And then the referee caught John Morrison attacking Kofi on the turnbuckle. He called for the DQ in 8:50. And Miz does not understand why John Morrison interfered. Because now Kofi has won by DQ, meaning that Raw gets another draft pick. And wouldn't you know it, the draft pick was The Miz. John Morrison broke up his own team because of his interference in this match.
What a
crazy timing.
What a coincidence.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So the Miz and Morrison shake hands and they hug, but then Miz attacks him and hits him with a neck breaker. Mm. And
I mean, these two were guys that when they came together, they ended up having a lot of success together. They did the dirt sheet on WWE.com together, and they ended up really improving their lot in the company through this tag team. Yep. And doing it kind of under the radar on ECW.
And at this point, they decided to break them up. And it would seem to me that they saw a bit more value in The Miz, positioning him as the heel in the dominant position coming out of it.
Yeah, so he would go to Raw, and Morrison ended up on SmackDown after the supplemental draft. So not a great night for ECW. Battle Royal time. We had the T-shirts war. Representing Raw, we had MVP, Crime Time, The Big Show, and Mike Knox. What a lineup. From ECW, we had Finley, Tyson Kidd, Paul Burchill, Mark Henry, and Ricky Ortiz.
I don't know if I've ever seen a Ricky Ortiz match before. This might have been my first.
And then SmackDown had Carlito, Primo, R-Truth, Chavo Guerrero, and Edge.
Uh-huh.
One person did not belong.
Yeah.
And they came out to that awful SmackDown song, which was only rivaled by the awful ECW song, Don't Question My Heart.
Mm. Yeah.
I don't even know how you question someone's heart. They mentioned that Edge won this prestigious tri-brand battle royal last year. Ortiz got dumped out first. There were just a lot of eliminations here. Mark Henry eliminated guys. Big Show eliminated guys. Eliminations. It came down to... yep. It came down to Big Show and Edge. Show ran at him. Edge ducked. Show sailed over. He was way more angry than a battle royal loss that was meaningless. Should have gotten under the skin of the Big Show. Like, this really meant nothing. And would it matter? You've been on this brand for about 20 minutes.
I think maybe it's more the fact that he lost to Edge, the person who is married to his love, Vicky Guerrero. Remember that?
Yep. Yeah, that's right. I guess, but they've, I don't know. Who cares? Edge is also bleeding from the mouth here. SmackDown gets two picks, the first being Kane, which was our second great Grisham call, yelling Kane's name at the top of his lungs.
Oh. Kane!
And Chris Jericho, who was on fire at this point. And now SmackDown, with the combination of Punk and Jericho, was starting to get some quality picks. And I think unloading Hunter from that show was kind of a net positive as well for that show. And having a strong main event scene when you've got Jericho, you've got Edge, you've got Punk at the level below. So some good things here. Then one of our favorite celebrities, Chili from TLC, was in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Stryker then starts singing Waterfall and says, stay away from Andre Rison's house.
What? Who's that?
Andre Rison was the football player whose house was lit on fire by a member of TLC.
My Left Eye.
Yeah, not Chili.
Yeah.
Did he not know who was who? Left Eye had died.
Close enough, I guess.
Like 7 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And he confused the two members here. Ross summarizes that Raw has 5 picks. SmackDown has 4 picks. ECW, 0. A pretty good replication of the prestige of each brand.
Mm-hmm.
Christian took on Shelton Benjamin. Christian from ECW, Shelton from SmackDown. Christian did this spot where he leaps all the way over the top rope to the floor in order to slap his opponent with all of that energy that he has stored up from that big leap onto his knees that are probably yelling at him. Benjamin leaps to the top, suplexed Christian off. Then Benjamin missed a reverse elbow from the top, which would have hit him right in the facebook. Christian then hits him with strikes, ducks a spinning heel kick, and then goes for the kill switch. It's blocked. It's a monkey flip. Benjamin lands on his feet, misses a splash, and takes the kill switch. So Christian wins in 3:53 as Stryker excitedly yells, we got one!
and he prays it's going to be John Cena going to ECW, which was awesome. So we've got the roster comes up. It's going through all the different names as they it lands on someone. Stryker saying, make it good, and it lands on Vladimir Kozlov. The highlight of the show for me.
And Matt Stryker's reaction.
Whoa!
Like he had just won the lottery. Oh, I wanted John Cena, but I mean, Vladimir Kozlov just as good.
We'll take him! What an awful, awful...
Oh, ECW just
brand.
Looked terrible coming off of this show.
Holy shit. Yeah. Cole and Lawler then gave their best trying to explain the stipulation tonight. Shane walks into Hunter's locker room. He says, Randy Orton is his. Hunter says, I thought we went over this. Stay out of my way. Batista walks up. He says, it's every man for himself. Shane just shrugs his shoulders. This was the least dramatic interaction I've ever seen amongst three people. And I didn't even know what they were arguing about, given that Orton's not even in this damn match tonight.
They're arguing about who should take the pinfall or who should get the pinfall. Because it's a foregone conclusion that they'll defeat Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase, no problem. It's just about who's going to get the pinfall. What I really still have trouble taking is the fact that they were trying to position Shane McMahon on an equal level with Triple H and Batista.
Oh, they'd put him above one guy's level later on in the show. Oh, this was...
They do it without any hesitation, you know? Like, and it's... I know why they do it. I know in the boss's mind. Yeah, this is how it works. We have Batista, Triple H, Shane McMahon, three people of equal physical stature. But as somebody just watching it, it's really hard to accept. Really hard to buy.
CM Punk and Matt Hardy were next. Punk had been drafted earlier. Matt as well. So we had Punk representing SmackDown and Matt representing Raw. They also plugged this E60 feature that was going to air on ESPN the next night on Vince McMahon and the inner workings of the WWE.
So how did this match work? Because CM Punk was just drafted to SmackDown and Matt Hardy was just drafted to Raw.
Yeah, so they're representing their new brands.
But when this match was booked prior, I mean, who were they representing?
They were probably opposites. It was still a match that was – you could have booked an inter-promotional match between these
two. That's not really fair, but let's say one of these guys was on ECW. And ECW just happens to lose a pick because one of their guys was drafted.
Neither was on ECW, though.
I'm saying if.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. It would have.
Okay.
Don't give it too much thought. Hardy caught Punk leaping out of the corner and dropped him down on his chest, which looked good. There was an abdominal stretch by Hardy. Punk landed a bulldog, lifted him for the GTS, but Hardy blocked, hit the side effect, and then Jeff Hardy runs down, attacking Matt for the DQ at 4:23. He's really pissing on his own brand here. Hits a gourd buster. There was a giant reaction for Jeff, one of the bigger ones on this show. And Matt just rolls out of the ring, runs to the back as Jeff chases after him.
Mm-hmm.
And so Raw gets a pick. And wouldn't you know it, the Divas champion, Maryse, is going to Raw.
Mm.
And thus we won't have two women's champions on SmackDown.
You know, there's just always a balance to the universe that finds its way.
Amazing. Chris Jericho and Tommy Dreamer were next. SmackDown versus ECW. There is an angle going on that if Tommy Dreamer does not become ECW champion by the time his contract expires in June, he will leave. Dreamer runs into a boot in the corner where gets worn down by Jericho. Dreamer then knocks him off the turnbuckle into a tree of woe, hitting a running drop kick. Goes for a DDT, but Jericho blocks, attempts the walls, and gets blocked. There was a sit-out spine buster by Dreamer. Then he climbs to the top, gets crotched, knocks Jericho down, and Tommy leaps and gets caught with a code breaker in midair, and Jericho wins. 4 minutes, 42 seconds.
These are just a bunch of random matches that really didn't tell any stories beyond this evening in the draft. I guess at the time there might have been some novelty in seeing these interpromotional matchups, but really none of them were compelling despite the very talented performers involved in all of them. They were just matches for there to be matches. I found Todd Grisham really awkward on commentary in some of these combinations because you had the announcers mixing as well. And here you had Todd Grisham being paired with Jim Ross. And it just sounded really awkward, Grisham trying to get in all his knowledge when you could tell the guy knows very little compared to the rest of the team that was there. And that included Matt Stryker. That includes Josh Matthews and Jim Ross and Grisham, all, you know, trying to pipe in with like, hey guys, don't forget this guy did such and such. It just made him kind of sound like a bit of a dork trying to keep up with the rest.
So from there, Jericho's win leads to the SmackDown pick of Intercontinental Champion Rey Mysterio, who ended a pretty awful run on Raw, where he was primarily feuding with Kane and then JBL, guys that you would automatically assume would be great, great feuds for Rey Mysterio, Kane and JBL. Moving back to SmackDown, and this would lead to a really awesome feud involving Chris Jericho and Rey Mysterio. And so once again, I think SmackDown, by the end of this show, Way, to me, was the show that I definitely think was bolstered by this draft when you include all these names. They plugged the supplemental draft, and also this week, the debut of Superstars on WGN with The Undertaker versus Matt Hardy for week one. That level of talent would quickly subside for Superstars. Main event was Triple H, Batista, and Shane McMahon against Ted DiBiase and Cody Rhodes. And my God, was Legacy's priceless theme. I could definitely put a price on it, and it would not be high.
Yeah, priceless.
It started with the words, "Yeah, I'm priceless." A horrible 2019. Shane attacks both men, of course, and then stomps Rhodes in the corner at the start. And he's throwing his left hands as he dances around. So, Way, you've been very critical. This was pre-Phil Nurse strikes from Shane McMahon.
I was wrong. This was maybe worse.
Well, then you can at least say he's been consistent.
Yeah, maybe Phil Nurse has improved him slightly.
Batista and Hunter take turns tagging themselves in as they work over Ted. Batista breaks up a cover when Hunter has the chance because both want Orton next week. Legacy gets the heat on Hunter. Crossroads gets countered and Hunter back body drops Cody and then crawls and tags in Batista. But then Shane comes in, clotheslines Cody and himself to the floor. Batista hits a spinebuster to DiBiase, calls for the Batista bomb, but Big Bad Shane breaks up the cover by attacking 300-pound Dave Batista. And Batista shoves Shane into the corner. Hunter tags himself in, allowing Shane to tackle Batista down to the floor. I don't think this went anywhere, as I recall. Hunter then pedigreed DiBiase for the win in 7:45, so we get Hunter and Orton in a WrestleMania rematch next week on TV from the UK, and guess what? That match died in front of the crowd, too.
Yeah. Well, I thought I was just embarrassed for Cody Rhodes and Ted DiBiase, who was really just put out here to look like two... I don't know, rag dolls for these three. I don't know, man. I thought overall this edition of Raw was just 3 hours of largely very quick, uninspired matches, and then a draft pick. You know, for the first hour, I didn't think it was so bad. The show kind of moved along at a good pace, but at the end of 3 hours, it got tired really fast, and I didn't think the roster, like, there's talent, you know, certainly, but like, it's certainly not at the level of talent that is on the roster right now, at least in terms of in-ring. The announcing wasn't all that great on the show, and the storylines were not good either. So I'm done with 2009 WWE for a long, long time.
Yeah, there will definitely be a moratorium on 2009 for the time being. I'll say it's also interesting how the product has evolved, as have these three-hour shows. Because here we're still in the era where you would get three-minute TV matches that – I mean, sometimes we complain about Raw that it's so long today, but – I mean, at least there's substance to some of the matches now on Raw. You might get your two-segment match on Raw. In fact, it's the norm that you're going to get a handful of those that you can at least get into the matches. And I think the way they book three-hour Raws, that has certainly evolved over time.
Yes.
Because I would not be into this every single week, like this style. Granted, there was a lot to this draft show with all the stuff you had planned, but it was – I mean, you're just getting these 3 and 4 minute matches that you're not really engaged in. The interpromotional factor meant nothing. And I think the positive of this show would have been, I think the SmackDown roster coming out of this. I think that you would, I think there were a lot of interesting names that you put on SmackDown, that you have a really good nucleus there when you look at the fact you have Edge, Jericho, Rey, Punk, and you also have Jeff Hardy still on SmackDown. Like, that's a pretty solid crew to have there. So that is going to wrap up our look at 2009. On a scale of 1 to 10, Way, where did the draft come on your scale?
Maybe 2.5.
2.5.
Yeah.
I will go 3.7, which was also the rating of this show. And we only got two pieces of feedback here, so let's do those real quickly, and then we're going to wrap up with our interview. And Christian writes, "The problem I have with this draft, and pretty much every draft they did, was how little the changes truly meant. Even something like leaving SmackDown with no world title, with both Cena and Hunter being on Raw by the end, didn't mean anything, as it just telegraphed that Cena would be losing the title to Edge at Backlash. This also highlighted my other problem, which is when they did it, there were 2 weeks out from the next pay-per-view. They could have held it off until the night after Backlash, and then you can start fresh storylines from there. I feel you guys have reviewed the low point of 2009, which was sadly around the time of their biggest show of the year. Just a couple of weeks later, they would produce the best wrestling pay-per-view of the year with Backlash, and we get the rise of Jeff Hardy and the great Punk and Jeff feud."
Yeah, maybe we should continue. Maybe we should just keep going.
Yeah, we'll do a weekly 2009 look back. I mean, 2009 definitely got better. It definitely had a lot, especially that spring on SmackDown and into the summer.
Keep it 2009.
Oh, yeah. Maybe that'll be ours.
All right. Finally, we got to Andrew, who says, "One could argue that 2009 may have been the worst year creatively WWE has ever had. Sure, in 1995, they lost money, but they also weren't a publicly traded company, and they couldn't really have a 1995-style low point ever again. 2009 was so bad that I feel if Impact Wrestling had the right management and booking team in place, they really could have competed with WWE. Their January 4th show did pretty well in the ratings, but they ended up going back to Thursdays and losing momentum before their switch back to Mondays. The big thing I noticed on this show is how the ECW brand was beaten into powder. It almost feels like they decided they were going to kill off ECW the next year and didn't want to invest any effort into making them look credible. Overall, this show was as bad as Jerry Lawler's tan and raccoon eyes. 2 out of 10.
The thing with the ECW was they didn't even try to mask it. I mean, it was so clearly positioned as such, and it was almost the running gag on this show was ECW being just the forgotten stepchild.
But now they've essentially done the same thing, but with NXT, where you're honest about how this is not an equal brand to the other two. This is a developmental system for our new guys, maybe the occasional, you know, superstar here and there, but it's being positioned not as an equal brand, which was really impossible to do with the lack of TV time and also the diminished roster.
All right. We're going to end the show with my interview with Brad Corbett, who was a member of the WWE creative staff at this time in 2009. So that's going to wrap it up for us. We will be back in 2 weeks on Friday, April the 7th, which is going to be coming out of WrestleMania, and we've got a special review. It's going to be our live show from Orlando, Florida. I had to think there for a second what city we're going to. Orlando.
Yeah.
So we hope to see many of you out there at the Barley and Vine Beer Garden happening WrestleMania Day, Sunday, April the 2nd. It's going to be kicking off at 11 a.m., and we'll have our Q&A-style podcast, and then that show will be up in this slot 2 Fridays from now on April the 7th. So you don't have to watch anything, Way.
No, you don't have to study this week. I don't think people even – many people watch this show too either. But yeah, so for those of you who can't unfortunately be there in Orlando with us, you will get to join in after the fact.
So we will hope to see many of you down in Orlando over WrestleMania weekend. Lots of big stuff going on. So here it is, myself in conversation with Brad Corbett discussing 2009. Well, we are back here on Review Away, and it's a pleasure to be joined by Brad Corbett, a former member of the WWE creative staff, as we are going back to this interesting period of 2009. And Brad, welcome to the show. I want to say for the second time, but this is actually the first time you've been on the show.
Thank you, brother. It's a pleasure to come and talk to you about your favorite time in the business.
Oh, 2009. I mean, to me, I've been saying it, Brad. The best build up for WrestleMania 33
ever of all time. Everything. This is a home run of all your favorite just pet peeves, right? Just the booking combined with the number issue.
Okay.
It's just
you've got to give me some explanation on the anniversary deal. I mean, was this just a running joke that they were just adamant to hammer home?
Sometimes things just happen, and I think sometimes Vince says things, and I think no matter what, it's in his head. And we all were well aware. We all said it. We all brought it up. That's what we were going with. And next thing you knew, we were 2 to 3 weeks in on saying this thing, and that's just what we were doing. There was no going back. And it's just – I mean, you see it all the way through, right? You've done all these shows where the numbers are just messed up, and it's in his head that that's what he wants to do. And I don't know if someone says that. Someone says, hey, we got to say this for this city. Why not just wait till the next city when it is the 25th anniversary? But – we were weeks in, and no matter what we said, we wouldn't get him to change his mind.
It was so funny because someone actually sent me a flyer for the next year's WrestleMania. I guess it was like the press conference to announce Phoenix, and yeah. It was promoted as the 25th anniversary of WrestleMania the following year. It was just amazing.
Obviously, that's coming from someone that was completely unconnected and just said, well, this makes sense.
I love it. The fact that you all protested, you have my undying respect.
Oh, yeah.
Now, let's just give the listeners at home an idea of, as well, your time period with the company.
Sure. So I started in March of 2008, which was a few weeks before WrestleMania 24 in Orlando, and I finished up in August of 2009, right before SummerSlam 2009.
So going back to 2008, for that year's WrestleMania, are you kind of just the new kid on the block, you're absorbing everything, whereas 2009, you're obviously much more involved, I would assume, in the process.
Yeah, 08, I knew nothing, right? So not only do you not know anything, no one really trusts you, and no one wants to tell you anything. And so you're just there. You've got maybe some things that they're asking you to do, but you know nothing. And I remember one of the clearest memories to me is in 08, right before Mania was about to kick off, Chris Jericho won the title from, I think, Jeff Hardy, and Jeff, right, I think, had failed a test. And here I am, a member of the creative team. I think I'm in the know of everything, and I just like, wow, we're flipping the title. Had no idea, and had no idea why. It came out like maybe 2 days later that Jeff wasn't going to be with us for a while. But yeah, those things, I was completely in the dark outside of maybe the finishes for Mania itself. It was pretty interesting to try and play catch up.
Yeah, and in 2009, that certainly seemed to be the MO of that year's WrestleMania, was keep people guessing up until the last available moment, because you look at the Royal Rumble to the February pay-per-view, and you get some kind of ideas, but all the titles were flipping, and do you look back at it as kind of a chaotic period where you guys want to hammer down what is the WrestleMania card, and it seemed like this was late in the game they were putting everything together?
It was pretty confusing. I would say, like, probably around January, we have a general idea of what the card's going to be. We've got a printed card that we travel with generally, or we pass around at certain meetings. And so we know what we want to do. But I think the issue is, and this was probably my difficulty of the process back then, was that everything was so focused on the main event, right? What's Taker doing? What's Edge doing? What's Hunter doing? What's Randy doing? What's mm-hmm. Batista doing? And then outside of that, when do you get Vince McMahon's time to say, hey, here's what we really want to do with MVP, or we really want to build something here with Shelton, or we really want to do this with, you know, whatever tag team? He would look at you so crazy because he is so focused on the quote-unquote money that he doesn't have time to think about the stuff that could become money in 6 months from now if you treat it right. So it was a lot of, well, we want to do this, but completely unknown to what our plans are because we haven't had a real chance to pitch it to him, Vince would just automatically say, well, we'll just do MVP. We'll just have MVP go in against Hunter, and then Hunter can beat, you know, as an example. And we might have this whole plan for MVP for the next 6 weeks, but he hasn't heard it. He doesn't care. And now we've kind of shot ourselves in the foot for an MVP plan because we just had him lose to Hunter. And so it was a very difficult time to just get his opinion or get his attention or approval on any long-term story for anything that would be considered mid-card.
Now, at this time, were you working on both Raw and SmackDown? Were you kind of exclusive to one? What was the setup like for the writers?
It was exclusive. So we had a Raw team, we had a SmackDown team, and then there was an ECW team. But for travel, we traveled to everything. And so I would be in on the meetings, at least at the arenas, on day of production for Raws or ECWs. And then the same team would come, and we'd all do the same thing for SmackDown.
And what did you get as just an aside about ECW at this time period? I mean, this was you know, a year out from the thing just being completely erased at this point. As a brand, I mean, this largely felt like the outside brand, hardly the kind of focus you get for, say, an NXT today.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was very NXT light. I just don't think the company knew it. I think that they were trying to – a lot of the guys that we had ideas for, the Jack Swaggers, the Abraham Washingtons, a few other guys during that time, we had a lot of ideas and we would pitch. And then in the end, if Vince didn't like it, essentially they would go to ECW, and that's where they would just go and figure something out. And, you know, Christian was able to – if Christian hadn't gone to ECW, it's very possible we would have brought him into SmackDown. Vince would have gotten sick of him after 2 years, and he would have just been gone. Instead, he was able to finish out a pretty full career, post-half career there. Same with Swagger, was able to hide there. Miz and Morrison were able to do stuff over at ECW and become kind of get their own showcase and get their own segments versus having to, again, like I said, the issue that we were having with a lot of our guys on SmackDown, the MVPs, the Shelton Benjamins. What do you do with these guys when you're trying to get the main guys over? The ECW guys didn't fall into that trap as much.
Yeah, it seemed that, you know, for some guys, and Miz and Morrison were great examples, that it was a place where they could somewhat fly under the radar and have more of kind of a editorial on their own creative, it seemed at the time. And those guys tried to just use the platform, and it used them, I think, effectively well at that point, because it seemed to ECW that you did get a little more latitude if you were the kind of talent that wanted to push your stuff through.
Yeah, and I think contrary to NXT, I think ECW got so much more play on the main roster between the other brands that when Miz and Morrison would show up on Raw or show up on SmackDown or be on the pay-per-view, it wasn't, who are these guys? You were pretty well aware of who Miz and Morrison were, even if you were only seeing a little bit of ECW, or you were only seeing the tri-branded 3-hour Raws that would come around, you know, quarterly or whatever it was. A lot more exposure for those guys versus what you would see in the NXT today.
And the team you were a part of, like, give us an idea of kind of the size of the staff at this time period. Was this just an army of people?
I think we were probably the first to really start building the softball team known as the creative. We had probably, I mean, myself, Michael Hayes, Krista Joseph, a few others that were in and out. Freddie had a stint during that time. A couple guys probably did a swap. So we probably had and then a few TV guys that had come in from that time, I think, on USA's suggestion. So at a time, we probably would have 4 to 7 SmackDown team members.
And how was Freddie Prinze Jr.? He seemed to get a lot of positive reviews from people.
Yeah, Freddie was a nice guy. Freddie was – it's hard. It's got to be really hard to have to want to do something, but you have to play the game. And so I think he had a lot of things that he wanted to do, and I think very quickly probably found out that people will say yes, but that doesn't mean that they're going to do it. And so I think Freddie was a great tool because he could get in Vince's ear. He could say something to Vince, and it might be one of our ideas that we were working on. But was Vince going to actually carry it out past telling Freddie yes? Who knows? But Freddie had a lot of great character driven stuff, especially with Jeff Hardy. He was really involved in Jeff's solo run with the title during that time. And man, I forgot about this, doing promos straight to the camera. That was a Freddie thing. Really just changing a little bit up of that. He had tried some things with MVP. I think that's where the losing streak came from at that time. But yeah, I think in the end it was the system, and again, no matter what you say yes to, are we going to do it? 3 weeks later, who knows?
When you mentioned that term, playing the game, like anyone in that system, I mean, in any job, there's an element of that. As you look back at your time there, was that something that you found you evolved with during your year and a half there? Was that something that you felt that you were ever able to do effectively?
So I think I have a forever problem of not knowing when not to say certain things, and I can't help myself, and it's been with me forever. And ultimately, I think that's probably how I ran myself there at WWE. And if something came up in my head, I would say it. And there were times that it would get a laugh, and at times, you know, Michael Hayes looks at you and you just go, "Shit, I blew this one." I wasn't a good game player. I don't think I even knew what the game was necessarily. And also being very young, I think it was probably 24, 25 then. I was pretty fresh out of college. I don't think I knew how to play the game, essentially, even if I thought I was, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So when I say WrestleMania 25, the 24th anniversary of WrestleMania to you, what are maybe the key programs that come to mind for you that maybe you had extra involvement with? I mean, what were kind of the performers you were attached with most for that big show?
I think the guys that I was dealing with myself were probably most of the guys in the Money in the Bank. I was always hovering around the U.S. title programs, the MVPs, the Shelton Benjamins. I was one of the things, though, I think probably I was very into, even if I didn't have a hand in, that just really stands out is the Shawn Undertaker program and seeing how that really evolved. And seeing that was Michael Hayes, Krista Joseph, and a lot of Taker and Shawn, just seeing how that evolved week to week. And Michael is really good at having a thought and bringing that to the team and then just saying, where do we go from that? And that it's heaven getting to hell line is something that he just kept saying over and over. And that's what the team would always work around. And these, you know, the light and the dark mm-hmm. and the casket stuff. And those were really fun times of just trying little things. Outside of that, the Vicky Edge stuff was always really fun. Vicky was just a delight to always work with. And Edge was just such a pro and just writing stuff. And then Vince saying, no, it's terrible, and throw it out and start it over. And Edge and Vicky are getting stuff like 20 seconds before they have to go out to the crowd. And may not have led up to the best build for stuff, especially with that three-way, but the actual TV that we were producing at the time was pretty fun with them.
Do you recall where you were watching the Undertaker Shawn Michaels match and just the reaction of anyone around you? I mean, did you guys know immediately this was something incredibly special?
I did not go because the team was so large that year. They did a scale down, and so only two people from every show went to Mania that year on the writing team. Yeah, it's pretty interesting because the rest of the company gets to go in every other division. But yeah, so we stayed in, and so I watched it with friends. And I remember, but I talked to everyone right afterwards, and right away it was, let's get ready for the second one. Immediately after the match, it was, let's get ready for the second one next year.
Wow.
And already trying to think of what's going to be the line that Shawn will drop and when will he drop it to let you know that he's not over the fact that he's just lost to The Undertaker. So that was a really big moment. And of course, you can't forget Sim Snuka.
Of course, yeah. I mean, just looking at that, the idea that you're going to catch this guy and you're going to be carrying a camera on top of it. I mean, I feel that guy got so much of the brunt of that. And it was like, look what you were asking this dude to do. Not the least of which this 300-pound man is going to angle himself to be torpedoing his head down into the ground.
And where was the camera footage? I thought the whole reason of him having the camera is so that we could see that footage of Taker coming crashing. But we never even got that. So it was sometimes... If it worked, right, he just lands on Sim, it's no big deal, and everyone just goes, wow, what a spot. But because he fell so horribly and he angled so, so bad, Taker just had a knack for just taking these crazy bumps, man. He did a TLC one. It was either the year before. I think it was the year before with Edge where he fell through, like, three different tables off of ladders. And he just had this knack for just taking these vicious, vicious bumps. And he's so big that the thud is ridiculous. So smartest spot? They'd probably do it again 10 times out of 10. If they had a chance to line it up again, they would just make sure that everyone was in much better place and maybe do a little rehearsal beforehand.
I mean, the other edge of the sword was that, I mean, it added so much drama to that match because everyone was thinking that this guy could be paralyzed. And when he's not and the match continues, you're so invested to an even higher degree at that point that it really it took the match to a new level after that.
Especially seeing Shawn in the corner there pleading and begging, hoping that Taker doesn't make it in for the 10 count. That's when it really hits home how bad he wants to win this match. I mean, just psychology at its best. Shawn was just so good at that.
After the fact, you mentioned that the first thought was, you know, building to the second one the following year. Was it the large consensus that if there was a do-over, that could have closed the show?
I think so. I think that's probably always the case. You guys mentioned it on your previous reviews of Hunter just has this knack on being on really long shows at the end against opponents or in programs that maybe don't live up to some of the mid main event matches. And I think you saw the correction again, you know, the following year that they knew what the right moment was. But I don't think everyone can necessarily feel the swelling of excitement all the time when you're so deep in it. And especially when it's something like a Hunter storyline, and it's Vince and it's the family, how do you not put that on last in their head? And so I think they don't realize that, man, this crowd's just going to go banana for Shawn and Taker. It's just one of those things that probably 20 minutes later they go, damn it, we blew it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the argument of, you know, putting your title match on last. I mean, there's in hindsight, of course, you can look at the result of things. But going in, I mean, to me, the Hunter-Randy program was really interesting because Randy, after the punt to Vince McMahon, was just so red hot that year.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you had this bridge named Shane McMahon in the middle of all of this that I just think cooled him off. And then we just got into the Hunter program that just was all over the place with home invasions and just, we've got all of this time until WrestleMania. And by the time you got to the finish line, which should have been a red hot program, I think you saw the effects there at the end of a big show. And it was just a program that people were just not as into as it may have been on paper 3 months earlier.
Yeah, and it wasn't fresh, right? We've seen Randy and Hunter many, many, many times. I think they do it on free TV a couple weeks later. And
yeah,
it's just not a... It's not a fresh matchup. I don't know if it's ever going to get that buzz that it is to them. But for them, I think it's the height of the potential that they saw in Randy. It was the height of the solo Triple H monster heel. And so it's the last remnants of the tail end of that attitude era, that 02-03, before the ruthless aggression really kicked in. I think it's somewhat romanticized by the company, that feud. But it's really even more so, I think, was a directive a little bit from USA. There was definitely a feeling that we needed to go to what was popular, what worked in the past, and family storylines is what came back from USA. And what is the only storyline you could do with a family and be sure that none of the parts are going to leave the company in the middle of the story? The McMahons. And so you get this with the super friendly Triple H and Vince and Shane all in this cool little crew, and you've got this guy that's kind of like a younger brother or a surrogate son in Randy Orton coming in with his own family of legacy. And it was really just, I feel like it was a thing probably to make USA happy. And I think probably we were doing crazy stuff back then. The PG thing had just come down, and I think we were trying to find ways to be exciting and explosive without cursing or having naked girls or things like that. And so that's where you get things like the home invasion and the entire Hardys storyline.
Yeah. You know, you bring up a fantastic point that doesn't often get cited, and that is the influence of your broadcaster in USA. And by extension, I mean the NBC family, that you look at the enormous rights fees that they pay this company, and quite often it seems like there's this distance between the two when really, as you outline, there isn't that. You know, it's perfectly logical that they answer to their broadcaster and they hold a huge amount of power within that system.
Yeah, I think it's always I think Vince struggles back and forth. I don't think Vince is blind to the fact that some stuff sucks. But I think sometimes it's worth the battle to make USA happy or whoever, whatever the corporate entity you know, a station or a sponsor in some cases, because we were still doing our own sponsorships back then. I think to get them happy is sometimes worth it if the fans crap all over it, but watch it anyway, if that makes sense.
Final thing here on WrestleMania, and then I want to ask you a bit about the draft, was you mentioned Money in the Bank, and it was a surprise that year with Punk winning the second straight year. But as you look, I mean, that was the opening for the big turn on Jeff Hardy, which I think was one of the best programs that year for the company. Was there a lot of debate about where we go with the Money in the Bank briefcase, or was Punk a pretty locked-in idea going in?
As I remember, we took a vote. They might have already had the directive from Vince, but I think we took a vote. And I think I purposely didn't pick Punk because I didn't want to be – I was afraid I'd be that one guy picking the guy that no one else likes, and I think I probably voted for Shelton. And to my surprise, Punk was the overwhelming pick, and we went – it was unanimous. We were going with Punk. There was never any wavering from weeks out. It was always going to be Punk. I don't hang on too many things from my time there, but since you say that you liked it so much, I will say one of the things I do always hang my hat on is I am the guy that said we've got to have Punk cash in on this Hardy Edge match. We weren't doing anything with Punk.
No.
When it came to SmackDown, not to jump too far ahead into the draft, but the plan was we were, I think, working Punk and Umaga during that time, and I think we were going to do it again, and I was looking at the roster, and I was like, what's left for CM Punk after this Umaga match? He's either going to fight Shelton Benjamin, or he's got to start fighting people for the title. And we had a call, and I think I brought it up to the team, and it was real silent, and then Michael got on the call, and then everyone says, well, it's kind of like threw me under the bus, I thought, because in my head, Edge and Jeff were Michael's guys, and this was me coming in saying, hey, we've done Edge and Jeff forever. We've got to do something new. And that's what I basically said. I said, we've got to do something with Punk or we're going to lose the whole value of Money in the Bank. And it was pretty immediate. It was like, okay, I'll pitch it. And that was it. And we were going with Punk.
If you go back and watch CM Punk at this time, I mean, it's just so fascinating to watch this guy who is just comes out, the big smile. And to me, the best comparison would be Dean Ambrose today, that I feel that guy, I think if he would very much be re-energized by the same thing that Punk went through in 2009, where you give him a microphone and you give him an issue and you let him go out there and just cut loose. And that's kind of the predicament Punk was in at the time. And then it ended up being a career turner, I feel, for him with the turn and the Money in the Bank briefcase. But he was one of the key guys moved over to SmackDown, and I think that largely revitalized him within that system, because staying on Raw, I don't think he would have had those opportunities that year.
No, he would have been lost in a sea of giants with the entire legacy evolution thing going on. We were really glad to have Punk. And I think, I don't know, I see him different as Dean, just because I think Dean is so much more character driven, a little bit goofy. And I think Punk, one of Punk's biggest things was he always seemed to remain a normal guy. He wasn't a character so much. He was straight edge. That was real. He didn't really have catchphrases. He didn't have costumes. He was just a guy that had some really cool movesets. And just it resonated in the same way that Jeff resonated. Jeff was just being Jeff. And I always compared the two of those, the yin and the yangs. You always saw the kids with the armbands for Jeff, and you saw the kids with the taped up fist T-shirts for Punk. And I really saw those two as very similar. Similar type of reaching similar types of audiences.
And of course the trifecta, the Vladimir Kozlov haircut, of course. That was the look for the kids in 2009. Side note is like the best moment of that draft is late in the show, and it was ECW has gotten zero picks.
None.
So far. Zero. They finally get one after Christian gets a win over Shelton Benjamin, and here you have Matt Stryker, who is just something else on this show, but nonetheless, just saying, oh, I hope it's a big one. I hope it's John Cena. I hope it's someone huge. And we do the long reveal, and out comes Vladimir Kozlov, and they sell it as, oh, it's Vladimir Kozlov.
Yeah, and you can see it by Christian's face. It's Vladimir Kozlov. He is just thinking, God, I hope I'm the next to be drafted out of here.
I will say, watching this draft, though, to me, SmackDown coming out of this looked like the show to watch, because you had Punk going over, but even more important at that time, you had Chris Jericho, who was red hot, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but positive or negative having Hunter off that show and back to Raw, because he comes with both his positives and his negatives, I would say.
Yeah, I think so when Hunter came the previous year, it was confusing for sure. And I think personally, I felt like it was just happening because everyone was saying he would never do it. And so I think it was just one of those things where he just went, yeah, fuck it, I'll do it. But quickly, we got so confused in the Raw tanglement that just really ruined what the brand extension was supposed to be in the first place. And we were never able to truly get away from that. So, yeah, for those reasons, I was glad to be able to get back to a much more stricter Team SmackDown roster. And to have Jericho and, you know, especially Rey, we had a really large push for the Latino audience, and we were losing that. And especially losing Rey just gave us no reason to have any push for the Latino audience. So having him back was great. And just to have guys you know you can have great matches with that the crowd knows, and guys that are just legitimately over. We had a lot of guys back then that were just not truly over. They were just there, and people knew who they were. People just knew who Shelton was. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't a guy that they were going to pay to see. And so to have a Jericho who was coming off a title run, who was red hot, who had completely reinvented himself, was in fresh new gear, it was really fun to think of what we were going to do with having those 15-minute promo times.
So as you – first of all, the draft itself. I mean, what's kind of the process there? I mean, how are these decisions made? Are you kind of in on these discussions? And what is the debate like when you're discussing with where we're going to put so-and-so? And I'm sure, you know, there's probably a lot of games being played where certain guys want to be one place. Others are arguing, no, he should be on our show. Just take us a bit into that process.
We all pretty much, I think, made kind of like wish lists. But with everything in the company, if you want it and you want to present it, you've got to be able to pitch it. You've got to be able to have a reason. You've got to be able to have options. And that's what's going to determine. That's what's going to get people excited about whether or not we're going to get that guy. But in the end, all they can do is take it to Vince, and he's going to say yes or no. A lot of times these things were eventually finalized in like a big time offsite meeting with a very small crew. So the rest of us would essentially load up, like we're loading the kids up for school. We load them up with all this paperwork and all these bags and all these rosters and all these different storyline spreadsheets. And then we send like six of them off to a private meeting room at a hotel with Vince, where they're going to be for hopefully 10 uninterrupted hours. And they're going to map out the next 6 months to a year and where they're going with this draft. And then they would come back to the office and say, here's what we got. And then that's it. It's pretty much set from that point. So once those guys left the office and went to those meetings, it was all in whatever they could convince Vince for.
Was it always a kind of a weird atmosphere the day of the draft, where, you know, I'm sure a lot of the talent didn't know where they were going? I mean, was it really a case of a lot of them were some talent were finding out on as it happens on television where they're going?
Yeah, I think other than probably Hunter and Cena knowing if they're moving or staying, and maybe a Randy or a Batista, I think most of them was a complete shoot. No one had a clue. You can see in some of their eyes when they walk out whether they're happy or sad. I think Punk looked pretty happy that he was coming to SmackDown. I think Rey looked pretty happy that he was coming to SmackDown. You know, you look at JR's, he was not happy he was coming to SmackDown the year prior.
Right.
And so I think guys, depending on what they're doing, they have a pretty good safe idea, you know, if what they're who they're working with at that time. If they're doing pretty well, they know they're not going to be moved out of a certain program too rapidly. And so I think some guys just kind of assume they're going to be fine, but no one truly knows except for maybe those top three or four.
A random name that comes up here, and I guess it's kind of relevant because he just left, was Jack Swagger. What did you feel about Swagger at this time? Because I was pretty high on this guy when he first came onto ECW, and, you know, his career really peaked the following year with the Money in the Bank deal. But someone that just he never realized that potential, and I think you could cite a variety of different reasons. Did you see something in him, or were you largely not as surprised that he didn't quite click?
I think SmackDown wanted him. He might have been originally a SmackDown. He might have been designated for SmackDown. And then, you know, what happened millions of times is that the pitch doesn't get to Vince, or Vince doesn't care about it, and it's just he's on ECW, and that's what would happen. And so we were high on Swagger. I don't think that there was ever a big idea as far as what he was. I know I wasn't a big all-American guy. I wanted to go a little simpler, a little bit more Midwest college football guy. Maybe a little bit. What was the guy from Jerry Maguire that Jerry O'Connell plays? Kush. Yes. A little bit more of like Kush. That's kind of the character I saw him as. And the All-American, I personally didn't know what that meant, what it was. And I think once he got mixed into the main rosters with John Cena, like I watched that match on the draft show, and they have a backstage segment where Cena just craps all over his entire All-American. And it's like, man, at that point, how can you take this guy or ECW seriously? And it was probably just a little quick side thing that Cena thought was funny, or whoever wrote it thought was funny. But in the end, I think it was very emblematic of how Jack Swagger's career was perceived past that point. And I think he got kind of jumbled up in all the injury bugs and getting pushed because there was no one left on the program because guys were hurt.
So as a result of the draft, how would you look at SmackDown and how it performed after? Because it had a lot of key talent. You mentioned the Jericho-Ray feud, which was outstanding. Then you had Punk and Jeff Hardy. Like, it seemed that, you know, coming on the actual draft episode, they made such a big focus on the picks Raw was getting, and Raw's got Hunter. But by the end of it, it was kind of the momentum coming out of it felt like it was with SmackDown, with a lot of new programs and tailoring things to their audience.
I think that's the nature of the shows, in the history of the shows. I think we took all those guys. We were very excited, and we had all new programs. We were pretty much doing Raw programs straight through on SmackDown. And so to get the Jerichos and the Rays and the CM Punks and some of the other guys that we got, and women, we were able to basically start over the way that I think most traditionalists think that you're supposed to start after WrestleMania. Versus Raw was continuing on into a Triple H Randy Orton story, which was exactly what they built WrestleMania on. And so I think that's still true today, and maybe it's the attention that Vince gives to SmackDown versus the attention that he gives to Raw. But I just think it's still very similar.
And it was also, SmackDown had to deal with the Edge injury a few months later, and that wiped him out for the year. So you add him to that mix. I mean, he was just getting that tag program started with Jericho, and it just seemed that, that was obviously a big blow on the SmackDown side, losing him.
Yeah, we were really high on that Jericho Edge thing. We had a lot of different ideas on where we were going to go with that. Where it would have truly gone, I don't know. In my head, I had a great build for an Edge huge babyface run against Jericho. But in the end, they were still able to get there. I think it was gone by the time they got around to that Mania, but they were still able to get there. But certainly, I think that gave Jericho a chance to strengthen his heel run on SmackDown, whereas he really had that chance in the summer and the fall on Raw to do it the previous year.
After you left the company, did you keep up on things, or were you like many and had to kind of detox yourself?
Brother, I was done for years, years. It is amazing. Even, the text messages would come in and it's like, hey, this guy's doing something, or this guy. And I couldn't even do it. Even now, I get tapped out after a while. I'll go a few months on watching some of the shows, and then I just go, I feel like I know where things are going. I feel like I have an understanding of the pacing. I feel like I could pick back up in 2 or 3 months and I'll know exactly where they were and how they got there. And so I just take some breaks. I don't think I've watched the show really since the rumble of current stuff. And so, it's just kind of it's a pleasure at times to be able to weave in and out, versus before being there. I think a lot of fans have that pull, that internal clock, Monday nights must turn on the TV. And I was able to really get out of that, thankfully.
Are you going to watch this year's WrestleMania? Are you, has anything grabbed you for this year's show?
I am going to watch. I host the WrestleMania party, oddly enough. And so I'll be the least knowledgeable of everything there. But let me try to think of what's actually on the show. I guess the AJ, I want to see what happens with AJ and Shane. AJ's rise through the company has been historical. I don't think anyone, myself included, ever would have thought that he would have reached this point. To where they'd even let him touch a McMahon, quite frankly. And while it may not be the match that fans want, I think in the company's eyes, I think they look at this as a huge gift to Shane or to AJ to have this spectacle versus, you know, I don't think that they look at the workers match as quite a gift as they do a match like this with a Shane. And so I'm really interested in seeing what they do with that. If AJ continues on and elevates, or if, as you say, the bridge of Shane McMahon comes crashing down.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I was definitely much more negative to the Shane program last year. This year, I mean, the buildup, I thought the attack angle they did last week was pretty strong. And, like, I've got a curiosity to see this match and AJ working with this guy. I think that they're, you know, I have more interest this year to see what happens. And AJ coming out of this, because, you know, he's been very effective in this heel run. And you've got a giant babyface run in him as well beyond this. So for a guy that's, you know, in the latter stages of his career, you know, he's doing it way better than anyone could have forecasted when he signed with this company. I don't think anyone could have imagined him reaching these heights within this company.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a historical run. No one, I don't think, this quick has had a legitimate. You've had guys that have come in and they've been pushed, but I don't think they've been accepted. And babyface or heel, this guy's been both, and this guy's been pretty much the best at either side that he's taken on either show. And it's pretty remarkable. I'm also excited to see just all the guys that aren't booked. What's happening with all these big guys? I feel like there's something brewing with the Braun Strowmans and the Brock Lesnar and the Undertaker and the Roman Reigns and all these things that just seem really unsure and kind of put together kind of quick, even though that was maybe their plan. There just doesn't seem a lot to it. And I feel like there's something that's supposed to come out on the back end of that. So I'm excited to see what is the story there.
Well, Brad, I really want to thank you for joining us and giving us a look deeper into this 2009 time period. I really wanted to get you onto the show to chat about this period, because you don't hear from a whole lot of people that were part of the process at this time. So it was fascinating to chat with you. Is there anything you'd like to promote on your end? Anything you would like to mention as we wrap up?
No, I'm not. I have nothing going on. You guys anyone can find me at Redshirt Play. I'll talk wrestling with anyone that wants to talk it. But other than that, I'm pretty much in the private sector now.
I love it. That's great.
You like it?
Full detox. Wrestling on your own terms.
It's exactly it, man. The Dave Chappelle of wrestling now.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for doing this, Brad. I hope at some point down the road we can have you back, maybe to chat about some of these SmackDown programs, because, you know, SmackDown had a pretty strong post-draft 2009 time period.
Yeah, it was a really fun time. I look forward to any time, man.